So I like to describe the evolution of the climate change regime as a play in four acts, starting with the Framework Convention in 92, which set the general framework of governance, then the Kyoto Protocol, which had legally binding negotiated emissions target, and then the Copenhagen Accord and Paris Agreements, which involve a system of bottom-up pledges. And with all of these, the ultimate goal is to try to reduce emissions, to stabilize concentrations of greenhouse gases at a safe level, and what's been called now the effectiveness trilemma. This is a function of three factors: the ambition of the regime, how stringent are the commitments to reduce emissions, participation, which countries are participating in the regime, and compliance. And the problem, of course, is that these three variables are interdependent. So if you push on one of the variables, it affects the other two. If you have more ambition, it tends to reduce participation or compliance and so forth. So it's a question of how do you maximize the output in terms of reducing emissions, given the fact that there are three independent variables. Now, just to preview where we are, we haven't been very successful in solving that effectiveness trilemma. This is showing the growth in fossil fuel emissions, that's in the black there, over the last 30 years. And you can see the emissions have been going up pretty steadily. And emissions are a function, according to what's called the Kaya identity after a Japanese economist. It's a function of population, that's times GDP per capita, times energy per unit GDP, and then fossil fuel use per unit of energy. And you can see over that 30-year period, there has been a steady decline in energy intensity. We're more efficient in using the energy, but the other variables, population continues to rise, and particularly GDP per unit, GDP per capita continues to rise. And the overall effect is, essentially, even though we now have the Framework Convention, Kyoto, Paris, you know, not much change in the trajectory overall. And in fact, if you compare the Copenhagen pledges in 2009-10 with the Paris nationally determined contributions in 2018, the emissions gap to get us on a pathway to well below 2 degrees centigrade, which is the goal of the Paris Agreement, where actually the gap is widened from the Paris pledges to the from the Copenhagen pledges to the Paris NDCs rather than narrowed. So haven't been too successful so far. So what I want to do now is just go back and try to describe a little bit how we've gotten to where we are, what the theory of Paris is, whether Paris is likely to change that situation, and then preview some of the issues coming up at the next conference of the parties. So this is just a very crude attempt to try to characterize three different approaches to international law: a prescriptive model where international law tells states what to do, a contractual model where international law memorializes and enforces what states agree to do, and then a facilitative catalytic model. The prescriptive model is law, the traditional domestic law model, where law is a hammer, you know, setting obligations, duties of different actors. And these can make some actors better off and some actors worse off. So if you think about the issue of loss and damage, which I'll come back to later, international law has to play a prescriptive role there, because basically if you provide compensation for loss and damage due to climate change, some countries are going to be better off, the ones that get the compensation, and some are going to be worse off, the ones who are paying the compensation. And you need some kind of prescriptive model as to why states would do that. And of course, the problem with the prescriptive model is how do you figure out who's prescribing the rules, where do the rules come from, and how are the rules enforced? International law is, in my view, a very small hammer for a very big nail, which is changing state behavior. So there have been now quite a lot of emphasis or interest in using the International Court of Justice, where they could basically just decide what the norms are, and then. But I think it's highly unlikely that's going to be very effective in actually changing state behavior. But I think the use of the ICJ is essentially premised on some kind of prescriptive model of international law. The basic approach of international agreements, multilateral environmental agreements, is a contractual model where it's based on reciprocity, and the agreement needs to make everyone better off in order for countries to agree. There needs to be some kind of contract zone that countries can agree to. And this was clearly the model, I think, of the Montreal Protocol dealing with ozone depletion. It was also the model for the Kyoto Protocol. So the Kyoto Protocol is based on a reciprocal exchange of promises that were internationally negotiated. And the theory was countries would be willing to agree to that because everybody would be better off if you can all agree to reduce your emissions. It was legally binding, so it's premised on the notion that you're trying to actually enforce these mutually agreed commitments. The price, of course, that was necessary to get that was a lot of differentiation between developed and developing countries, because developed countries were willing to accept this approach, but developing countries said they're not responsible and shouldn't be subject to this approach. And the problem, of course, as a result, if you look at it in terms of the effectiveness trilemma of the Kyoto approach, which was this contractual approach, relatively strong ambition in the emission reduction commitments, at least in theory, strong on compliance. There was a lot of emphasis in the Kyoto process on a strong compliance system. A lot of effort went into that. But then in terms of participation, didn't cover most of the world's emissions, because it only covered Annex 1 emissions, not non-Annex 1 emissions. And then, of course, in the second commitment period, a lot of the Annex 1 countries were not willing to continue in this approach, and the participation went down. So this is just showing in this slide the countries with targets in the first and second periods. The green are the ones who agreed to targets in the second period, and you can see it's a diminishing amount, covering less than a quarter of global emissions. Okay, so, and why did the contractual model not work, which was, I think, the approach that had been successful in the Montreal Protocol context? I think it's because climate change is heavily driven by domestic politics, so it's not a question of reaching some agreement between states where they all think they're going to be better off by mutually agreeing to reductions in emissions. It's driven by a lot of domestic political factors, and I think most of the important states, including the U.S., China, India, although Levon, you could speak better on that than I did, they're not willing to do more, really, in exchange for more being done by others. It's not a question that the U.S. is going to take a stronger target just because other countries have. It's what targets they're able to take, what targets they decide to take, is going to be driven much more by domestic political factors than it is by what's happening in the rest of the world and what other countries are doing. Okay, so we now get to the third model, the facilitative model, which I think is the approach of the Paris Agreement. So, and so let me try to describe this model. It's a little bit vague, I would say, probably much significantly under-theorized still. But the idea really starts with the idea that states are willing to do something on their own, and the role of international law in this context then is to try to encourage a learning process that changes perceptions of self-interest, so states are willing to do more. By focusing international attention periodically on the issue, you help empower domestic political constituencies, so you make it easier for domestic politics to be able to produce a stronger outcome by focusing attention on it. Transparency focuses soft pressure on countries through a system of peer review to try to encourage them to do more. And then a system of assistance internationally enhances the capacity of states that want to do something but lack the wherewithal to make a lot of progress. So I think this is the idea of the Paris paradigm. And the Paris paradigm, as I've described it, has really, I think, four key elements. Countries nationally determine their contributions to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Those are the nationally determined contributions. You have a system of transparency to promote ambition and accountability. You have an ambition cycle to promote stronger action over time. And you have a nuanced approach to differentiation. So let me just go through these four elements of the Paris paradigm quickly and then relate it back to the effectiveness trilemma. So first of all, NDCs. So this is a bottom-up process. This is not a system based on reciprocal exchange of promises where what one country does is interdependent on what other countries are doing. Each country unilaterally decides what it's willing to do based on its own national circumstances, its own politics, and so forth. So it's a very bottom-up system, not a system of top-down negotiations. The top-down element of this, so Copenhagen initiated this kind of bottom-up approach back in 2009. Copenhagen had essentially no discipline to it, so it was almost impossible to know even what countries had pledged. So that was problematic, because if you think countries are going to pledge things and then you want to focus soft pressure on them so they do more, you need to know what they pledged to do. With Copenhagen, it was kind of like the Wild West, where it was so ill-defined, hard to even know what countries were pledging. So Paris tries to then have some top-down elements to impose a bit of discipline in this, on the system, to try to promote progression and ambition over time. But essentially still, though, largely a bottom-up system of nationally determined contributions. Not legally binding, so no emphasis here on the legally binding character of the contributions. There's no obligation to achieve one's NDC, one's nationally determined contribution. And as a result of allowing for this nationally determined approach, they didn't require then the stark differentiation between developed and developing countries. Every country basically is subject to this regime. Countries self-differentiate what they're doing by their choice of NDC, but there's no explicit differentiation in most respects. Second element, an emphasis on transparency. So rather than have a strong compliance system like the Kyoto Protocol did, the emphasis is on transparency as an engine to try to get countries to both do more and also to hold them to account for what they've done. So virtually all of the legally binding obligations in the Paris Agreement, with the exception of finance, are procedural obligations. They're procedural obligations relating to transparency. So countries have to communicate an NDC every 5 years. They have to provide information to make it clear what they've actually pledged in their NDC. They have to account for their NDCs. Then they have to report biannually on their emissions and their progress in implementing and achieving their NDC. So a series of procedural obligations to basically get countries to be transparent about what they're planning to do and how they're doing, how well they're doing in actually achieving what they said they're going to do. There's also some international review mechanisms going along with these national transparency requirements. So there's a technical expert review process, a process of peer review, by countries of one another's actions, and then there's now this new implementation and compliance mechanism. The third element is this idea of an ambition cycle, which is supposed to ratchet up ambition over time. So everyone agreed the Paris pledges and the NDCs back in 2015 were inadequate to put us on a pathway to well below 2 degrees centigrade. So the idea is that in these five-year cycles, every 5 years, countries have to come back and make new pledges or updated pledges. And this follows a process of, this follows a process of a stock take where there's an international review as to how the world is doing reaching the goals of the Paris Agreement. And then as following these stock takes, so there's an international sort of stock take as to where we are and how the world is doing, and then countries have to then submit a new or updated NDC that's informed by the stock take, and the idea is the stock take will then focus pressure on countries so that in each successive iteration of this process, their NDCs will become stronger, and then over time, your ambition level will rise. That's at least the theory of this. And then finally, fourth element, a more nuanced approach to differentiation. So because this is a softer approach, a nationally determined approach with only procedural obligations, there wasn't the insistence by developing countries about having sharp differentiation between what they were going to be doing and what developed countries were going to be doing. And there's a much more nuanced or refined approach to differentiation in the Paris Agreement. So on mitigation, self-differentiation of NDCs, as I mentioned, fairly limited differentiation of normative expectations. On finance, in contrast, there still is bifurcation between developed and developing countries. Developed countries have obligations to provide finance. Developing countries are encouraged to do so, but are not required to do so. So there's still a much more traditional approach to differentiation with respect to finance. And then on transparency, you have a system where it's a common transparency system with common rules that apply to all countries. So again, very much in contrast to Kyoto or the Framework Convention, But there's provisions for flexibility based on need, based on need. So it's not differentiation based on your developing country status. It's differentiation or flexibility based on your need because you have inadequate capacities to meet the reporting and other transparency requirements. Okay, so just going back to the effect of this trilemma with the Paris Agreement. So I think the idea here is on ambition, you start with low ambition, but the ambition cycle is what's intended to ratchet up ambition over time. So the ambition starts low but increases. The benefit you get from low ambition initially is higher participation, so very high participation in the Paris Agreement, much, much higher participation than certainly Kyoto, but I mean, not even just close. Kyoto's now at about 15% of global emissions that's covered, whereas the Paris Agreement covers, I think, well over 95% of global emissions. Of course, if the U.S. does, in fact, drop out of the Paris Agreement, that will go down, but it will still be a large, large majority of global emissions that are covered by the Paris Agreement. And by the way, I might say that Monday is the first day the U.S. can give notice of withdrawal, and I've been reading news reports that President Trump is likely to withdraw the U.S. He won't withdraw the U.S. next Monday. He'll provide notice of withdrawal, which then takes a year to become effective. So U.S. withdrawal at the earliest wouldn't become effective until essentially 2020 election. So in my view, the 2020 election is one of the more important things that's going to happen in the next several years, influencing the climate change issue. And then finally, compliance. So there's a reliance in the Paris Agreement on transparency rather than legal bindingness as the way to promote compliance. So instead of having legally binding obligations to achieve your NDC, instead of having a very strong compliance system, the idea is that if you actually require countries to come forward and report on what their emissions are, how they're achieving their NDCs, what their progress is in doing so, that is going to put pressure on them to actually comply, and that will be as effective as having some compliance committee make a finding of non-compliance. That will exert as much pressure. Okay, and just in terms of Paris Agreement, it's sometimes been called the Goldilocks solution. It's trying to hit the sweet spot between something that's top-down and legally binding, like the Paris, like the Kyoto Protocol, which got very low participation, and something that's completely bottom-up with really no rules whatsoever, that's not going to be very ambitious, not going to provide much accountability, which is what the criticisms of Copenhagen were. To try to find some sweet spot where you have still a bottom-up system of nationally determined contributions, but with some international rules, as I said, to try to promote accountability through transparency. It is a treaty. There's no question that it's a treaty, but I'd say the most important element of it, which is the nationally determined contributions, is not legally binding, so it's a hybrid in that respect. And then again, with differentiation, it's neither full differentiation like Kyoto, no differentiation like many multilateral environmental agreements. It's this in-between. So it's a in-between in all three of these different dimensions. All right, so so Paris was adopted in 2015, considered at the time a major diplomatic achievement, but it still left a lot to be decided because how the actual provisions of them would work would depend on what the rules are for implementing them. You know, exactly what were countries supposed to do in terms of reporting, what kind of information did they have to put forward to make sure that their nationally determined contribution was understandable, how would these different review mechanisms work. Those all remain to be elaborated. And I think in thinking about the elaboration of the Paris Agreement in the Paris Rulebook, it's important to differentiate two different tasks the rules perform in the Paris Rulebook. So one is to elaborate parties' obligations. So here you have general specification of obligations in Paris, and the question is, what do those mean? Do you leave it up to countries to self-interpret what those obligations mean, or do you try to spell out the obligations in greater detail? So that was one of the two tasks of the Paris Rulebook negotiations. The other task was to operationalize the different mechanisms in the Paris Agreement. So these are not trying to elaborate parties' obligations. These are to try to specify how the different international components of the Paris Rule Agreement would work. So how would the technical review process work? How would the multilateral peer review process work? What would the implementation and compliance committee look like? There are two different market mechanisms specified in the Paris Agreement. What would be the rules for how those two different market mechanisms would work? So it's the second task is to operationalize the different international mechanisms. And the two tasks are different, let me just say, in that in one case, if you don't reach any rules, parties still have their obligations. If you can't elaborate their obligations, they still have obligations. They can self-interpret what those obligations are, but they still have their obligations. So the failure to agree to rules on parties' obligations doesn't really completely eviscerate the Paris Agreement because countries still have obligations. They can criticize one another in terms of whether or not they think other countries are satisfying their obligations and so forth. If you don't have rules, though, for how the international mechanisms work, then you don't have international mechanisms. If there's no agreement as to what the composition of technical expert review committees are, then you don't have them. If there's no agreement as to how the implementation and compliance system is going to be set up, it just doesn't get off the ground to begin with. So I'd say a major question post-Paris was whether Paris is a real meeting of the minds or whether Paris just papered over differences because you had 100 whatever heads of state there and they couldn't, you know, be fail, so you had to have a success. So they found some weasel words that allowed them to get out of Paris and declare a victory. So the question was there really any meeting of the minds in Paris, or was there a lot of constructive ambiguity, which then countries really would try to renegotiate post-Paris? And so here, the cartoon is, you know, they're all the bubbles that they're thinking are, you know, they can't stand what's been agreed, but then of course they all say yes. So that was sort of the question coming out of Paris. And so what this means is, to what extent would the Paris rulebook attempt to, I'd say, be faithful to at least how I understand the Paris paradigm, or to what extent would countries simply be trying to renegotiate Paris? And this has been basically the history of the climate change regime, that whatever's agreed is never really finally agreed. The countries constantly are trying to renegotiate because they've agreed to something that they don't really accept. And this is true, I think, of all sides. So I'm not just pointing the finger at a particular set of countries. I'd say it's a equal opportunity kind of effort where all the different countries have never been fully satisfied and try to, you know, shift the what's been agreed afterwards. Okay. So there are these three recurring issues that have underlined underlay the negotiations from the start. I've more or less described them already, and they still continued in the Paris Rulebook negotiations. How much international prescription, how much top-down negotiation of rules versus how much bottom-up, allowing countries to nationally determine things, how legally binding or not legally binding do you have things, and how uniform are the rules or how differentiated. And these were big issues in the Paris Rulebook's negotiations. And there's a whole range of options you could have for each of these. So for the issue of how much detail versus how much to leave national discretion in the rules that were being negotiated in the Paris Rulebook, you could have no guidance. So countries nationally can decide how they implement their obligations. You can say parties get to decide, but they have to be transparent about it, so they can't, whatever rule they decide, or whatever interpretation they take of a particular provision, they have to be transparent. Or you can have detailed guidance where you internationally specify what the different obligations mean. How binding are the rules that are in the Paris Rulebook? The guidance could be merely illustrative, just listing a series of options that countries may decide to do. It could be a recommendation, using the word chill, it could be mandatory, so then a range of options. And a differentiation, also a range of options, from no differentiation to a very strong differentiated system with various shades in between, where you have something uniform but with some flexibility built in, where you allow countries to self-differentiate and so forth. Okay, so a huge question as to whether the Paris Rulebook would actually be successfully finished. It wasn't actually fully finished in Katowice, but it was largely finished, I think, to some people's surprise, because there were a lot of different issues. There was extremely little progress pre Katowice and solving those issues. The text was a complete mess. So when they finally adopted the Paris rulebook, or most of it, in Katowice, that's the Polish president at the meeting jumping over the table in joy for having actually gotten out of there with something to declare as being successful. And I think they were able to reach agreement by this extremely careful calibration that they, similar to what happened in the Paris Agreement, where you see a huge range of different approaches for different provisions. So each provision is carefully calibrated according to those three dimensions I was mentioning, top-down versus bottom-up, legally binding versus not legally binding, and differentiated versus not differentiated. So you have some elements of the Paris Rulebook that are purely optional, so things are specified as illustrative, but not required or even encouraged. So the elements of an adaptation communication is an example of this. So the elements of an adaptation communication, they just list a bunch of things that can be an element of an adaptation communication. They, parties may include that. So that's at one end of the spectrum. Some things are recommended, like on the provision of finance. The Paris Rulebook says the kinds of information countries should provide, but doesn't require them to provide it. Some provisions are required that allow for self-differentiation. So the information countries have to provide to make their NDCs transparent, to make them clear and understandable. Paris Rulebook has a lot of very detailed rules about what information you have to provide, and it says you shall provide this information, so it's a mandatory, but then it says you shall provide it as appropriate. So they take away with one hand what they required with the other one. It's required, but it's only as appropriate. So by self-differentiating your NDC, you can affect then what information needs to be provided in your when you're supporting your NDC. You could also require something, but then carve out exceptions, obviously. So in the National Inventory Reports, very detailed rules again about what's required to be included in your National Inventory Reports. They're very, very detailed. But then there's various flexibilities, or essentially exceptions, that are carved out for developing countries based on their capacity needs. In some cases, it's self-determined, so there is no international prescription. Countries get to self-interpret what their obligations are, but they have to be then transparent. So you have to provide indicators of progress as to what progress you're making towards achieving your NDC. But you get to decide what those indicators are. There's no specification as to how you're going to actually measure whether a country's making progress. You can self-determine what your indicators of progress are, but you have to be then transparent about it. So if you come up with an indicator that's completely bogus, the theory is, and you have to then be transparent about it, then you give other countries a target to shoot at and criticize. So you need to come forward, if you don't want to, if you want to look okay, you need to come forward with an indicator that's credible, because you have to put it forward, and then it's going to be subject to criticism. And then finally, in some cases, you do have differentiation. So on the reporting on finance, that's required. What financial assistance you give, that's required of developed countries, but it's only encouraged for other countries. So you see this I think, much more complicated approach in the Paris Agreement and the Paris Rulebook than you had in most earlier multilateral agreements, where it was much more uniform in terms of these issues of legal bindingness, in terms of how much international specification of the rules there would be, in terms of differentiation. Here you have a huge range of possible combinations that then are, most of which are then used in one part of the rulebook or another to differentiate the legal force of provisions, to differentiate the detail of the provisions, and to distinguish how uniform or differentiated they are and what countries they apply to. Okay, so let me just very quickly describe a few of these elements in a little more detail, not too much. So on the mitigation question, there were really three issues about elaborating the Paris Rulebook dealing with mitigation. There was one substantive issue, and then there were two procedural issues. So the substantive issue was, do you spell out what features NDCs have to have? Do they have to have a unconditional component of what you say you're going to do regardless of whether you get finance? Does it have to be quantified or not? So these would be features as to what your NDC had to be. And the Paris Agreement says nationally determined, you know, so virtually no specification of features. And a lot of countries said if you start specifying features of NDCs, you undercut their nationally determined character. But you say they have to be quantified. What if a country wants to nationally determine a contribution that can't be quantified? So on that, I would say the Paris rulebook was pretty faithful to the Paris Agreement. They couldn't agree to anything in terms of specifying features. This was an attempt to try to do in the rulebook what hadn't been possible to do in Paris, which was to allow to limit the discretion countries had in nationally determining their contributions by specifying features that NDCs had to have. The only feature that looks like it may be not nationally determined is what the time frame of your NDC is, because countries' NDCs in Paris have different time frames. U.S. says this is what we're going to do in 2025. A lot of countries use 2030 as their target date. Some have an NDC that's a budget of emissions over a period of years, whereas U.S. NDC is simply what the emissions are going to be in a single year. U.S. has what's called a single-year NDC as opposed to a Kyoto-like NDC, which is a budget of emissions over multiple years. So question was, so this makes it very hard to compare NDCs, is the U.S. doing as much as China, how do you compare, if one's 2025, the other's 2030, if one's a single-year target, the other's a budget, very difficult to compare. So there has been a lot of push to try to get common timeframes for NDCs, which would limit national discretion but provide for some ability to make the NDCs more comparable. They, of course, couldn't reach any agreement on what those common timeframes would be, but they agreed to agree in the future. So they agreed to agree by 2031, that they would agree that from 2031, NDCs would need to be have common timeframes, but they couldn't agree yet on what those are. So they're going to continue discussions on that. But that's at least laying down a marker that at least in one respect, nationally determined contributions will have some international requirements, namely having some common time frame. Most of the focus, though, on the procedural side of mitigation, so a detailed elaboration of the information that countries have to come forward. It's called ICTU. It's the information necessary for clarity, transparency, and understanding. So this is basically information to make clear what your NDC is saying, what you've actually pledged to do. So a lot of detailed elaboration of that. It's legally binding. It does leave national discretion because it has those words as appropriate. But in terms of sort of thinking, what did Paris do? And is Paris rulebook sort of on the same track? Paris was strong, I'd say, relatively strong. On a relative basis, it was strongest on transparency. And again, here in terms of the Paris rulebook, by far the strongest part of the Paris rulebook is elaborating the procedural requirements of the Paris Agreement on transparency. This can also be seen not only in the mitigation decision that deals with mitigation, but also on the decision dealing with the enhanced transparency framework, which is Article 13 of the Paris Agreement. So I won't go through this in too much detail, but there's a lot of elaboration in the Paris rulebook of the emissions inventory requirements countries have to do. I mean, it's really a lot of technical detail in there that they actually agreed to multilaterally, spelling out what you need to do to report on progress towards achieving your NDCs. There's still the idea that it should be a structured summary to make it easier to compare the reports, although that still has to be elaborated. So I'd say probably the strongest element of the Paris rulebook is the transparency provisions dealing with reporting. Much, much weaker, I'd say, in terms of the review processes. So transparency consists of coming forward with information and then, in theory, allowing for some kind of international review of that information. I'd say the review provisions significantly weaker because the technical expert review process is really only looking at the consistency of the information provided with what the rules require. All it's doing is looking at, what does the rule say and what information you need to have, and have you provided that, have you complied with the rules. It doesn't look substantively at whether the information is accurate or not. So if you just make up information and submit it, so long as you've submitted it in the right way, you're not going to get reviewed by the technical expert review process. And then a very, very modest system of peer review, basically just Q&A, and you have to show up and answer some questions. but not, again, I would say a very strong process of peer review. So strong on the obligations on countries to, the obligations of countries to provide information. So the transparency requirements strong, but I'd say weaker on the international review processes. And then just finally, differentiation. So this is one of the more interesting parts of the Paris rulebook, how to reflect differentiation between developed and developing countries in the rules about transparency, because really the guts of the Paris Agreement are the transparency rules. So the question is, to what degree are those transparency rules going to be uniform for all countries, or to what extent would they distinguish between developed and developing countries? So because transparency was such a key element of the Paris approach, the provisions about differentiation relating to those transparency requirements are key. And I think it's a very carefully calibrated system of differentiation here. So there's not differentiation or flexibility for all developing countries. It's only for developing countries on the basis of need. So just the fact that you're a developing country does not mean you're entitled to flexibility. It's that you have to have some capacity constraints. What you have flexibility on is very carefully constrained, because the agreement, the rules spell out which particular aspects you can have some flexibility and what that flexibility consists of. So it's flexibility only for certain provisions. The types of flexibility, like, you know, most countries have to report something every year, and you might get 2 year, every 2 years, something like that. It's very carefully defined and circumscribed what your flexibility is. So this is highly internationally negotiated, your flexibility is nuts. And you have to identify the specific provision for which you are asserting flexibility. So you have to be transparent about it, and you have to provide some rationale as to why you need flexibility based on your capacity. So this is, though, so very carefully circumscribed, but then you get to decide whether you qualify for flexibility. So it's nationally determined. You get to decide, I need flexibility, but then what kind of flexibility is circumscribed, and you have to provide some rationale for your self-determination that you need flexibility. Okay, so this slide needs to be changed, because as of yesterday, the Chilean president announced that due to the civil unrest in Santiago, they would be canceling hosting the Conference of the Parties, which was scheduled for the first 2 weeks of December. So at this point, I think, I was talking to Lavanya about this before we started, you know, extremely unlikely they'd be able to hold it in this year, because these are gigantic conferences, you know, with tens of thousands of people. So trying to find a new venue for it and get organized in the next 6 weeks is basically impossible. So they'll almost certainly have to postpone it, find some new venue in 2020 to do the COP25. So that's all on hold at the moment. I have no idea what's going to happen. So eliminate these two pictures. These are no longer relevant. They should have X's on them. So let me just describe, whenever COP25 is held, assuming there is a COP25 at some point in the future, what it's supposed to be doing. So just looking forward for a few minutes. So one is to complete the Paris rulebook. The second is to review the Warsaw International Mechanism, which I'll describe in just a second. The third, which probably won't be the case now, it was supposed to be a blue COP, because Chile has been very big on the idea of the relation of oceans and climate change, and so they had announced they were going to do a blue COP. This is one of the areas where COP presidencies get to define, to some degree, the political agenda at a COP, and so Chile was going to use the COP to promote oceans. Since they're not going to be hosting anymore, we can, I think I'll just eliminate my slides on the blue COP, because that's unlikely to be the case, unless the other, wherever else it's held, is similarly inclined. And then the final one is raising mitigation ambition. So let me just run through these quickly, and then so there's time for some questions. So the first is completing the Paris rulebook. So I said most of the Paris rulebook was wrapped up in Katowice. The rules dealing with mitigation, the rules dealing with adaptation and finance, there weren't that many rules on those, but the team said there were rules, those rules. The rules on the enhanced transparency framework, which were key. But the part of the Paris rule book that was not agreed to in Paris was the rules for how the market mechanisms would work. And the market mechanisms are under Article 6 of the Paris Agreement. Article 6 provides for two market mechanisms, one which is essentially about emissions trading under Kyoto, the other, which is essentially like this clean development mechanism under Kyoto. So one is a emissions trading system, and the other is what they're now called International Transport Mitigation Outcomes, ITMOs, but it's the same kind of concept. And the article, the one like CDM is a project-making mechanism, so if you undertake a project that reduces emissions, then there can be allowances that are created that then can be used by other countries to meet their NDC. So then the idea of these mechanisms, like market mechanisms generally, allow parties to reduce emissions at a lower cost, but then two other ones that many countries are pushing for the market mechanism. So the traditional argument for market mechanisms is cost effectiveness, efficiency, but then two other ones is to contribute to overall increase in global emission reductions, so to raise the ambition of the agreement, not just to make the efficiency of achieving a given level of ambition better, but to raise the ambition and to contribute for adaptation, to provide financial resources, basically, for developing countries. Let me just go to this a little quicker since we... The Article 6 rules do establish obligations for parties that are going to do emissions trading. They basically have to have robust accounting. They have to make sure that emission reductions aren't double counted when you're trading them from one country to another. So those are obligations in the Paris Agreement itself. The market mechanism under Article 6.4 is supposed to deliver an overall increase in mitigation globally. But then the conference of the parties has to adopt rules to operationalize it. No agreement on rules in Katowice on either of these two things. Tons of issues. I was just at a heads of delegation meeting where this was all being discussed, and you know, the technical complexity of a lot of these is way over the heads of, I'd say, most negotiators. It's been a very slow process. Highly questionable whether they, if there had been a meeting in Santiago, whether they would have been able to reach agreement. I'm not going to go through all of these, but I'd be happy to discuss some of the issues in the Article 6 process if people are interested in that during the Q&A. I think just the one thing to note is the implications of not reaching agreement in Article 6 are different for the two mechanisms, because the first mechanism, the emissions trading, countries can basically do from day one if they want to. There are obligations about how they do it in the agreement, but they can just go ahead and start doing transfers of mitigation outcomes. So the only purpose of the rules is to elaborate those requirements in the agreement further. If there's no agreement on that, countries can simply self-interpret what those obligations are and go ahead and trade. With the mechanism, though, so they could just proceed with ITMOs with these transfers, emission trading transfers, if they're in the agreement. The Article 6.4 mechanism, in contrast, has to have rules to operate, because if there are no rules, there's no mechanism. So it's asymmetric what the implications of failure to agree to the rules are for the two mechanisms. All right, so that was the Article 6, working out the Paris rulebook. Review of the Warsaw International Mechanism. So let me just go through this a little quickly that I was planning to. So Warsaw International Mechanism is dealing with loss and damage from slow onset events like sea level rise, desertification, and ocean acidification. And it's also dealing with extreme weather events, loss and damage due to hurricanes, heat waves, floods, huge amounts of damages as a result of these. And it was established back in 2013. There was a review in 2016, and there was supposed to be another review this year if there had been a COP that was supposed to take place in Santiago. The terms of reference for the review were adopted back in June. The objectives are very nebulous, as they usually are in these processes, but I'd say two main issues. So one issue is the Warsaw International Mechanism subject just to the Paris Agreement, or is it also subject to the Framework Convention? Because particularly if the U.S. withdraws, there's going to be not complete overlap between the memberships. So the Paris Agreement said it's subject to the Paris Agreement parties. It was established under the Framework Convention, so a lot of countries say, but no, the Framework Convention parties also, it's subject to their governance. So the question is, does it have two masters, both the Framework Convention and the Paris Agreement, or does it simply have the Paris Agreement as its master? And the other issue is, should the Warsaw International Mechanism simply be essentially information exchange and coordination, or should it have some role in mobilizing finance? should it have some role in localizing finance? So that's a substantive question as to what the functions of the Warsaw International Mechanism, whether to go beyond the original conception of the Warsaw International Mechanism, which was very much informational and coordination in nature, to something more broader than that. Oceans and climate change, well, this is going to be a theme of the Chilean presidency. So the first two, by the way, things I mentioned are things that were on the agenda. So the Article 6 rules, the Warsaw International Mechanism review, those are things that are on the agenda that were supposed to be dealt with formally in the meeting. The last two things I mentioned here are not things that were on the agenda, but were political objectives of the meeting. So not formally part of the agenda, but political objectives. And one was the Chilean idea of integrating oceans better into the climate regime. I'm going to skip that, since that probably is unlikely to happen at the reconvened COP. The other is to raise ambition, because as I started by saying, the ambition of the Paris NDC is inadequate. Everybody agrees to that, so the key is to try to raise ambition over time. The next round of NDCs are due in 2020, so Santiago COP was going to be the last COP before countries came forward with their revised NDCs, their new NDCs. So the idea was to try to use the Santiago COP as a way to mobilize political pressure on countries so that when they come forward with their NDCs in 2020, they're increasing their ambition. So this is just showing the existing NDCs. This is a review by Climate Action Tracker, which reviews NDCs. And you can see, based on whether they're critically insufficient, highly insufficient, insufficient, compatible, and so forth. And you can see most NDCs, particularly by the big emitters like the US, China, are either highly or critically insufficient. India is the only one that comes out comparatively well on this assessment, at least. I don't know how methodologically sound the assessment is, but this was at least one prominent assessment by an NGO. But you can see, you know, generally speaking, a lot of insufficiency. In terms of, this is a slide I already showed, we need to be increasing ambition by billions of tons in order to put us on a pathway to 2 degrees, much less 1.5 degrees, which is the stronger goal. And this is supposed to take place through this ambition cycle where there's information, technical assessment, a stock take eventually, and then new NDCs, and that's supposed to be providing for increasing ambition over time. This is just a schematic sort of how it's supposed to work. I would say, and then this was the main theme also of the UN Secretary General Summit in New York back in September. Secretary General convened the New York Summit largely as a way to try to again focus political pressure to get countries to increase their ambition. I think most assessments of the New York Summit were that it was disappointing in terms of raising ambition. 70 countries announced they'd enhance their NDCs, but they represent only a small fraction of global emissions. Most of them are small island developing states who contribute insignificant amounts of emissions globally. So in terms of the big emitters, that was not the case. 65 countries pledged they'd get to net zero by mid-century, but again, it's mostly smaller countries. Some European countries did. Stronger, though, in terms of financial support and non-state initiatives. So there were significant pledges of financial support in New York to the Green Climate Fund. So I think people were encouraged by that. Now, that's sort of treading water because the U.S. has pulled out of the Green Climate Fund. So but it's making up for some of the loss of revenue from the U.S. And then quite a few corporate pledges, which if fulfilled might be significant, but again, as with some of these other kinds of pledges, there's a question as to how much accountability there will be as to whether or not they're fulfilled. And then you have also now a growing social movement, youth movement, and again, I think that's something that is encouraging, but unless it actually changes political elections, it's, you know, it won't have an overall effect that much on global emissions. So so the task for the next COP,
for Bonn,
for wherever it's held, wherever that may be, is how do you motivate leaders to enhance ambition? I started by saying, you know, the Paris paradigm is modeled on this idea that if you have regular cycles of review, and it creates political moments every 5 years as a result of the global stock takes and the need to convert to the new NDC, countries will feel pressured both internally through domestic political process and externally through international pressure to come forward with stronger NDCs. A completely untested approach, I should say. Really no, I think, strong models of examples where that's worked in other areas. But I think if we're going to, if the Paris Agreement is going to work, that model is really what it's going to rely on. So that concludes this very quick overview. I'd be happy to answer questions or go into some of these things in more detail. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Remy. It's done. Over to you for questions. Yes.
Hi, my name is Archana. I'm a practitioner. I call I. I